Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor's autobiography arrives this week. It's entitled My Beloved World, and it reveals far more about Sotomayor than was disclosed during her confirmation hearings. It chronicles her life from the tenements of New York to the halls of Princeton and Yale to the New York District Attorney's Office and eventually to the Supreme Court. To talk about all that and more, Sotomayor sat down with NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
The first Hispanic justice knows she's a role model to many. Still, her searingly candid book exposes not just the joys, but the warts of her life, too. Her father's alcoholism, her conflicts with her mother, and the disease that often dominated and disciplined her childhood, diabetes. So why did she write a book that exposes so many of her own personal vulnerabilities?
I think to move people beyond just dreaming into doing, they have to be able to see that you're just like them and you still made it. I realized I had to tell them the truth. And so this book is about that truth.
That truth is often painful. Her book opens with her parents fighting over who will give her a diabetes shot. At age 7, Sonia says she will do it herself. And she learns to boil the water, sterilize the needles, and to inject herself, a skill she performs today with such ease that few notice when she does it in the middle of a fancy dinner party. Her childhood, however, was fraught with conflict as her father's alcoholism grew more and more pronounced.
I describe in the book the moments of just carefully watching as he got drunker and drunker and just waiting for the moment where he could hardly walk, so we had to leave wherever we were.
This was the father she adored, though, a wonderful cook, a man with a sixth-grade education, but so gifted with numbers that one of his jobs was as a bookkeeper, a man so creative that, as she would later learn, when he worked at a mannequin factory, he modeled one of the mannequin faces after her mother.
And she said it was such a strange sensation to visit the factory and to see hundreds of her faces coming out of the factory.
Her mother, in contrast, was chilly, remote, disciplined, working nights and weekends instead of days to escape the chaos of her husband's drinking.
She spent a lot of time out of the house, and I actually did feel abandoned by her.
The source of Sotomayor's warmth and protection was her grandmother, her father's mother, Abuelita. Sonia would spend weekends at her grandmother's tiny apartment, and always, in those early years, there was a party in the evening.
People would be playing dominoes, they would be dancing, they'd be singing. At some point in the evening, the music would stop, and I would know that the poetry would start. I would go under the table at times just to watch my father and my grandmother recite poetry. People were mesmerized. Those were perhaps some of the happiest memories of my childhood.
But the alcoholism finally took its toll, and Sotomayor's father died. She was 9. She'd already seen him slipping away and was not surprised at all. But after years of watching her parents fight, she was not prepared for her mother's grief.
I don't think I remember a warm moment between them. And so it seemed really strange to me that she couldn't stop crying after he died. And she became morose. We'd come home from school, she'd cook us dinner, and then she'd lock herself in the bedroom. And the pattern repeated itself day after day, week after week, month after month.
And then Sonia Sotomayor broke.
I banged on her bedroom door, and she came to the door, and I said, "Are you going to die too? Please stop this. What's going to happen to Junior and me? Stop." And I ran back into my bedroom, threw myself into my bed, and cried.
The next day, her mother emerged from the darkness.
And I got back from school, and the radio was playing in the house. And that was the first sounds that I heard in the apartment since my dad had died. And my mother came out, and I still remember it, in a black with white polka dot dress, her hair made up. And I knew at that moment that she had come out of whatever she was in. My mother became a different woman. And I often talk of before daddy and after daddy, because my life was dramatically different thereafter. She began to really start nurturing us as a mother.
It was the beginning of a long path to understanding and forgiveness between the two that would take many decades, culminating in interviews that Sotomayor did with her mother for this book. She thought initially, for instance, that her mother was so grief-stricken because she felt guilt over her husband's death.
But I learned in writing the book that it was just genuine grief about losing a marriage to a man that she had truly loved and who, yes, she couldn't save, but it was really the end of a life that she had had.
Her mother, Selena, it turns out, was ill-prepared for marriage or motherhood. Born in Puerto Rico, she grew up in a shack with no running water, nothing to eat, foraging for fruits and nuts, and taking care of her ailing mother. At 9, she was an orphan, taken in by a much older sister and sent to school.
She had no role models growing up. She really transformed herself from a child with, you know, a basic education, with no understanding, as she said, of how to dress, of how to act, of how to even have friends.
At 17, Selena lied about her age, enlisted in the WACS during World War II, went to basic training in Georgia, and was assigned to New York City, where she met Julie, her future husband, at a party. After Julie's death, she would go on to support 2 children on her salary as a practical nurse and then go back to school to become a registered nurse. She would always teach her children the value of discipline and education. But mother and daughter only came to a true understanding of each other over time.
It has taken us, my mother and I, a lifetime to deal with the effects of my father's alcoholism on both of us. It's often a mutual ignorance that causes, I think, people to be angry at each other and not forgive. And one of the greatest lessons of my life with my mother is both her capacity to forgive and the gift of her teaching me how to as well.
More from our interview tonight on All Things Considered and tomorrow on Morning Edition. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
George Saunders is the author of several collections of short stories, and he's been praised by the likes of fellow writers like Jennifer Egan, Dave Eggers, and the late David Foster Wallace as the quintessential writer's writer. Still, he wasn't exactly a household name until a couple of weeks ago. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan plays catch-up by reviewing Saunders' latest collection called 10th of December.
I was baffled by the cover of the New York Times Magazine 2 Sundays ago. You may remember that the headline of the cover story was, "George Saunders has written the best book you'll read this year." I was baffled because the only George Saunders I could think of was that old movie star who was always playing cads in films like Rebecca and All About Eve. Actually, that actor's name was George Saunders. Adding to my anxieties was the fact that, according to the article, everybody else in the literary world had already anointed Saunders the writer for our time. So I asked a few serious reader friends, the kind of people with subscriptions to N+1, if they've read George Saunders. One friend said she thought she'd read a story by him in The New Yorker. The others came up blank, except for the one who suggested Saunders might be that debonair actor who always played cads in old movies. Which is all to say that it's tough to make a mainstream name for yourself as a writer, even when you're a writer who's won a MacArthur Genius Award. Hence that deliberately provocative headline of the Times Magazine article, which succeeded in its goal of making me want to read Saunders' new collection of short stories called 10th of December. It would be so satisfying to topple that Olympian Times pronouncement, but in good conscience, I can't do it. 10th of December probably will turn out to be one of the best new books I read in 2013, because Saunders is indeed something special. The 10 stories in this collection are mostly told in the first person. Thoughts and conversations ramble, and they always seem to have begun an hour or so before the reader shows up. Saunders' style is postmodernism with a friendly face. His technical scaffolding insulates heart and humor, stories that are actually about something beyond their own gleaming nuts and bolts. Even my least favorite pieces here, ones like Escape from Spiderhead that fall into the futuristic sci-fi genre, carry an emotional charge. That's especially true of the longest tale, The Semplica Girl Diaries, which is a dystopian domestic comedy. Our diarist is a hapless suburban dad of three. He keeps alluding to a status symbol yard decoration called Semplica Girls. When the dad splurges on a Semplica Girl arrangement to surprise his surly teenage daughter, we find out that Semplica Girls, or SGs, are poor young women from places like Moldova and Laos who've sold themselves as tableau vivant garden ornaments. At installation, a wire is threaded through their brains and they're hoisted up as on a clothesline. As the dad excitedly jots in his diary, SG's up now, 3 feet off ground, smiling, swaying in slight breeze. Effect amazing. Having so often seen similar configuration in yards of others more affluent, makes own yard seem suddenly affluent. You feel different about self, as if at last you are in step with peers and time in which living. That entry reads as though goofy Phil Dunphy from Modern Family were exulting because he finally could afford slaves for Claire and the kids. What barbarities are normalized in a culture, that story asks, but with a light touch, no preaching. Other tales start out as comedy or satire and mutate into near tragedy. In Puppy, a mother who's furiously trying to construct a happy childhood for her kids arranges to buy a puppy from another woman, also a loving if misguided mother. When the two moms meet, their worldviews chemically collide to blow up each other's cherished illusions. In the opening story, Victory Lap, we hear about a sad teenager named Kyle, who's down to one friend, a guy, we're told, who was always retrieving things from between his teeth, announcing the name of the retrieved thing in Greek, then re-eating it. Just as you're wincing at the exuberance of Saunders' description, events swerve into violence. By the end of Victory Lap, nerdy Kyle has faced down evil, while his parents, who sought to cosset him, are the ones who need to be told reassuring fictions. Saunders' short stories have it all: the flexibility of language, the social criticism, the moral ambition, the entertaining dark humor. Check back with me at the end of 2013. If his collection isn't in this year's top 10, it will really have been an extraordinary year for books.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed 10th of December by George Saunders.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skeep.
I'm Renee Montaigne. And Steve, let's face it, when you're a child, sometimes adults can be a real drag. The new Captain Underpants book puts it this way. Do you ever notice how grown-ups hate it when kids are having fun? David Pilkey's Captain Underpants. And you know, I think you're familiar with that book, right?
Graphic novels. I've seen a few of them around the house.
Are full of potty humor, wacky illustrations, and names like Tippy Tinkle Trousers. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports there's a new Captain Underpants coming out today.
If you want to impress some boys, just pull out the new Captain Underpants.
Awesome. Who wants to read the title?
Me. Captain Underpants and the Revenge of the
The Revolting Revenge of the Radioactive Robo-Boxers. Rex Exnicios, Sundiata Haley, and Aiden Kaliva, second graders from Lusher Charter School in New Orleans, are huge fans because they say Captain Underpants is silly, has great pictures, flip-o-ramas, and with titles like
Captain Underpants and the Big Bad Battle of the Bionic Booger Boy,
and characters with names like
Professor Poopy Pants.
What's not to love? Here's an excerpt from the new Captain Underpants, read by Sundiata Haley.
If you're like most kids, you're probably reading this very book because some adult wanted you to quit playing video games or watching TV.
When I write for kids, it's really kind of an us and them type of situation. It's like me and the kids versus the grown-ups.
Author Dave Pilkey says he remembers what it was like to be a kid who got in trouble for his pranks. He also remembers what it was like to be a struggling reader.
I remember every kid in the class would have to stand up and read a chapter from our history book or something. And whenever it was my turn, everyone would just kind of groan like, oh, Pilkey's reading again. And it just took me so long to get through it. And I had all these really negative associations with reading. I just hated it.
So he wanted to make a children's book that even kids like him would find irresistible. But some grown-ups, true to form, think it's inappropriate for the heroes of a children's book to be such troublemakers. The two main characters, George and Harold, are big-time pranksters. They draw a comic strip in which they turn their mean principal into the superhero Captain Underpants, who wears nothing but a red cape and underwear.
The number one complaint is... This is kind of funny. Nudity, I guess, because the superhero has on jockey shorts.
Pat Scales is chair of the American Library Association's Intellectual Freedom Committee. She says Captain Underpants has made it to the ALA's hit list 3 times. That's their annual list of the top 10 most complained about books.
Vulgar language. They feel that kids are being taught not to obey authority.
In the books, the principal hates George and Harold's comic strip. Some parents have problems with it, too, not for the content, but for all the misspellings. Laugh is spelled L-A-F-F. Trouble is spelled T-R-U-B-B-E-L. 7-year-old Rex Exnicias from New Orleans says that really bugs his mom.
She gets really mad because lots of stuff is misspelled in them.
So what does she say?
She's just like, that's misspelled. How you actually spell it? She just like spells it.
Pat Scales of the American Library Association says Rex Exnicios' mom is on the right track. Scales, who's a big fan of Captain Underpants, wants grown-ups to take it a step further and use George and Harold's mistakes as an opportunity to teach kids about literature.
What I would ask kids, how does this represent the character of the two boys? What kind of students do you think they are? And then you can take it a step further if you're a teacher or even a parent and have the kids write it out properly and say, how does this change the tone of the book? And how does this change the humor of the book?
Eventually, says Scales, kids figure out how to spell the words correctly. That's what happened to Titus Adkins from Brooklyn. He's a senior in high school, but he says when he was little, Captain Underpants were the only books he liked. And he says they were the jumping-off point to more books.
I started reading The Chronicles of Narnia when I was in second grade.
Wow.
Because of Captain Underpants.
Just because it was a book or because it was Chronicles of Narnia?
It was because it was a book that my mom told me to read, and she said it was sort of like Captain Underpants. She kind of lied to me to get me to read it.
A trick that could have come straight out of Captain Underpants. Titus Adkins says he got hooked on the Narnia books, too. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
If you haven't had your breakfast yet, this may get you in the mood. If you have had your breakfast, this may get you in the mood for seconds. Our colleague David Green recently had a visitor and a cooking lesson.
Hello. Maricel?
Yes.
Hi, I'm David Green.
Hi, David.
Very nice
How
to meet
are you?
You.
Nice
Welcome
meeting
to
you
my
too.
Home.
I have Camarillo, the book.
You have a restaurant in a suitcase.
More or less.
My guest, Maricel Precia. She's a petite woman with one huge personality, and she dragged this rollerboard suitcase down to Washington, D.C. from Hoboken, New Jersey, where she owns two restaurants. Now, she doesn't like the word chef. She says it sounds too French, but she's written a lot of cookbooks, and her newest is a guidebook to Latin cooking. It's called Gran Cocina Latina.
Here, I brought yuca.
So that's what a yuca looks like. It's brown. It's shaped sort of like a big cucumber, I would say.
A big cucumber? Are you kidding? Have you seen a cucumber of that size?
No.
Not even
really
an English
big cucumber.
Priscilla, who's a native of Cuba, has cooked in kitchens all over Latin America. And she brought one of her recipes to my kitchen.
Yuca fries with cilantro sauce a la Priscilla. I need a big knife. So we cut this yuca into 4 or 5 inch length, cutting through 2 layers of skin. So you see there's a thin brown, bark-like.
It's almost like the bark
skin.
Of a tree. You're,
exactly.
You're peeling off
exactly.
The bark.
Now, let's get a pot of water. And then let's start cooking.
Okay. So tell me about the name of the book.
Gran Cocina Latina, The Food of Latin America.
And it is a massive book.
It's
how many years of work
went
into it?
My whole life. My whole life. There are recipes there of my childhood, things that I remember my family, my aunts doing, but also things that I learned as I started to travel through Latin America. For example, I went to Mexico, and I remember being in Oaxaca, and I befriended a woman who was a very good cook, and she made tamales with the black mole from Oaxaca, and I just love those tamales, and I love the sauce, and I took down the recipe very carefully.
Now, those yucas have been boiling for a long time. They gotta
yeah.
go for a while?
Yeah, they're done. You see, they start to open. There's a section here, it's like a spindle, that you have to get rid of before you cut this into fry length pieces. All right, so we're gonna make the cilantro mayonnaise, and you know, there is a story about this.
What's the story?
The yuca fries with cilantro sauce are now in every Cuban restaurant. Well, it's my recipe. And I did that because I was so in love with yuca. I was experimenting with yuca. And I said, yuca needs a sauce. So I said, okay, I want to do something similar to cilantro chutney, something that I learned in India. So when I went back to my house in New Jersey, I just experimented with it. And I created this creamy alioli, almost a mayonnaise with garlic and cilantro. And so everybody who tries that thinks it is an authentic traditional Cuban recipe, when in reality Cubans don't like cilantro that much.
So we're bringing a marriage of India and Latin America here, right?
So when I started doing this, of course, I used to make my own mayonnaise. But
I don't need to. I don't need to make my own mayonnaise to be able to make your recipe here.
No. You need help with mayonnaise, and so it's about 2 cups. You need about 2 cups
into the blender.
Into the blender. I'm chopping cilantro now. Did you get the hot peppers?
We have hot peppers. We're both standing here, but you talk about the value of sitting when you're doing cooking Latin
some
American
chores.
Cuisine.
Absolutely.
I
call it the zen of the Latin kitchen.
Ooh, the zen.
The
so
zen.
We're not zenning out here.
No, we're not.
Standing.
We're not because we're doing something with a knife. But in Latin America, there are many chores like preparing the dough for tamales, wrapping tamales, or grating coconut to make coconut milk that do not require standing up.
So you
can
sit.
You can even lie down in a hammock. All right. So it's about 1 teaspoon of cumin.
Okay.
I love cumin. It's an elusive spice. I also use like 1/2 teaspoon of the oregano and about 1/4 teaspoon of the allspice. So you have to go easy because allspice is powerful. All right. So we're going to puree.
What does this tell us about a Latin American dish and how it can kind of evolve with a new spin in the United States?
What's happening in the U.S. is that the U.S. is another Latin American country because all Latin cultures are coming together. So it's really unavoidable that sooner or later you're going to start learning from your neighbor. Maybe in your own country, you guarded your pot. But when you're here, you're on the same boat.
The rivalries just melt away.
So they melt away. I was shocked by how much we share when I started traveling Latin America. Sometimes it would be something very, very subtle. I would be, for example, in Cartagena and we get a taxi. I begin to bond with this man and we start singing. And we know the same songs. And they're not Colombian songs. We're singing Mexican songs.
Can you give me a line or two of one of the songs you're
Mexico
singing?
Mexico lindo y querido, si muero lejos de ti. Que digan que estoy dormido.
Pretty. So what are you saying? What are those?
I'm saying, you know, if I, my dear Mexico, if I die, you know, outside of Mexico, please bring me back. So we both get teary-eyed and we start singing this song.
So you're Cuban, you're with
yeah,
a,
I'm
a
Cuban,
Colombian,
so I'm with a Colombian.
Singing
we're singing
a Mexican
song. I think that we should check the yuca and see how we're doing. Okay, you're going to cut this.
So it's like thick French fries. We're ready to fry?
We're ready to fry.
Now, let's give us the setup here. We've got vegetable oil.
Yes. So what we want to create is a beautiful, pleasurable crust, you know.
We have a yuca in the oil.
Looks like a jacuzzi.
It does look like a jacuzzi. Yeah, it's a bubbling oil.
Yeah. Try to get it golden like this.
All right, then you put it on a plate with a paper
yeah.
towel under it.
Okay.
Is it tasting time?
So it's tasting time.
I'm going in.
Oh, yeah. That is really tasty. Mm.
The result that is really this dish that is very simple but very appetizing is something you can do when you have guests and you have your mojitos in the kitchen or your caipirinha, and it's about conviviality. People are there watching you fry this, and they eat the yuca fries with the sauce as you fish it out of the fryer, and so it's just perfect.
Well, we're going to dig in here, but first, Marisol Garcia, thank you for coming into my kitchen. This has been so much fun.
Oh, for me, it's been fantastic. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
And that was our colleague David Green with Marisol Garcia. You can find recipes from her book, Gran Cocina Latina, The Food of Latin America, at our food blog, The Salt, at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. The poem by Emily Dickinson, I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room, inspires the title of a new biography of Dorothy Rinch, a path-breaking mathematician who faced in her life the kind of tumult that scientific inquiry sometimes inspires. Few people outside the sciences have heard of Dorothy Rinch. In 1929, she became the first woman ever to receive a doctorate of science from Oxford University. That only begins her largely unknown story. Smith College professor Marjorie Seneschal's new book is called I Died for Beauty, Dorothy Rinch and the Culture of Science. Seneschal begins by telling us about their relationship.
She was old enough to be my grandmother, but I met her because I had trained as a mathematician, but I became very interested in crystals, and I didn't know anybody who knew anything about that. And by a long route, I found her because she had gone the same path. And she had taught at Smith for many years. Now she was retired, and she still had her office. She worked every day, all day. And someone told me I should go see her. And so I did. I knocked on her door, and that changed my life.
You know, I just have to say, the two of you bond over the most wonderful book, which I'm so pleased to know about, called The Ornament of Grammar by Owen Jones. This is actually going to lead you to studying crystallography. Tell us about how the two of you were fascinated by that book.
This book is a book that was published in 1865. It's so heavy that you can hardly lift it up. It's 100 beautiful plates of ornaments, like wallpaper and rugs and tiles on walls and ceilings from all over the world and all different eras. And this had been compiled in the 1860s by Owen Jones. And the only way to really reach the true sense of ornament was to go to the rest of the world and see how they did things there.
And she's using it to draw her models, and that's also what's drawing you in.
These particular beautiful ornaments are analogous to the way that atoms are arranged in crystals. And that's why we were fascinated.
So Dorothy Rinch, to step back a bit, she's born in 1894 in South America, but she grows up in a nearly rural suburb of London. She goes to a wonderful school for girls, a special school, and she becomes one of Girton College's first pupils when Girton is still a brand new school. It'll later become part of Cambridge University. What is she like, this young woman? Why is she remarkable?
Well, her determination was certainly one thing. I mean, she was determined to be a mathematician. She worked her head off. She was known, everyone considered her the biggest workaholic they ever had known. But at the same time, she was very vivacious and gregarious. She had a knack for making friends. Her best friend, Dora Black, said that she was, in fact, the most driven and person who had the clearest sense of what she wanted to do of anybody.
She develops a theory of the way proteins are formed, the architecture of proteins. Could you tell us about that?
They had just discovered, they being the protein chemists, the chemists in general, had just discovered that proteins were molecules. And this is so taken for granted today that it's hard to imagine a time when they didn't understand that. When it became clear that they were molecules, meaning that there was a definite structure, that the atoms were in particular places, their role in our lives, keeping us alive, had to do with where those places were. Then the question is, well, where are those places? And the one theory that had been proposed before was that it makes a long chain. That's still what people believe. But she said, no, that that's not the way it is. So she proposed instead that the chains form rings, and the rings join together. And she came up with a model that looked like lace. It was absolutely beautiful. And then she would have the lace fold up, so as if you're making an origami cage.
You have many pictures of that in the book, and you describe her as going to the grocery store to buy tapioca balls and then dyeing them and sticking them together. And she told you what store you could go to in Cambridge to do this.
That was very funny because you dye them with food dye. I still have all that stuff. And then use Elmer's glue to stick them together with and use a toothpick for the applicator. It was very funny, but they work. I mean, you can make beautiful models that way.
All this beauty, there's so many ways that you play on that concept of beauty is truth or beauty is it science. The subtitle of this book is The Culture of Science. And in the 30s and 40s, this is such a male-dominated culture within our male-dominated culture.
Yes.
I loved your sentence. You take her to Cold Spring Harbor, a very important scientific conference in 1940, and you say, what is she doing here? What is she doing here? What is she doing here?
And then later I have, what is she doing here? And every single way that you could read it is what people were saying about her.
And then not long thereafter, science being a world then is now supported by grants torn by rivalries, she's attacked by another scientist, Linus Pauling. Now, we know now that Linus Pauling will go on to win two Nobel Prizes, but he is utterly vicious to her.
And he thought it was perfectly fine to be that way, because here she was a mathematician, she didn't know what she was doing. It's true she didn't know very much chemistry, and he could always nail her on the details. But she had a beautiful vision that had excited many, many people, many, many scientists, many of them Nobel Prize winners, thinking that there must be something to what she's saying because it explained things so well, so many of the properties that they had wanted to have explanations for. And Linus Pauling thought she's wrong because she doesn't have the chemistry right. She was assuming there was a bond that he didn't think existed, although it did. And so he just decided to do her in. It was literally that. And to march into this fray and get rid of her by laughing her out of the profession.
What impact does it have on her career?
It destroyed it. It just destroyed it. She pulled herself together and began working on X-ray diffraction theory.
She becomes an academic, and I think you could say it's certainly not a bad thing to wind up teaching at Smith College, but that was not the life that she'd envisioned.
It's just that she was so marginalized, and she never gave up. She kept on working to the very end.
Did Dorothy Rinch think she was a failure at the end?
There's some very touching notes that she left. She said, it's really okay not to be Proteins Newton. There are other things. You can make other contributions. And she was writing these notes to herself. So I think she had hoped to be somehow the one who really, really brought Newton's kind of light to the whole subject of biology, and she didn't. And then she was trying to console herself that she'd done some things. But I wanted to write about her because she'd always stayed with me after she died. I thought about her a lot.
What does the theme I Died for Beauty suggest to you?
It suggests to me the struggle that she had with Linus Pauling. As you read at the beginning the first stanza of the poem, and let me read the second one, which is the one that I think that touched me the most and made me realize this had to be the title. I was scarce adjusted to the tomb when one who died for truth was laying in the adjoining room. And then the next stanza, he questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth, the two are one. We brethren are, he said. And this is what I think the whole story is about on the intellectual level, is the struggle to look for simple answers to complex questions, and we do this all the time. We try to wade through the data, wade through the complexity, and see what's really going on here. But sometimes we don't find that. This is an ongoing sort of dialogue between truth and beauty that I think is continuing in science everywhere else today.
Marjorie Seneschal, her new book is called I Died for Beauty, Dorothy Rinch and the Cultures of Science. Thank you, Marjorie.
Well, thank you so much, Jackie.